chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Rest my dab in the middle. We are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off this second hour, but she joined us on that first hour, and man, that was a great hour. Charlotte really enjoyed broadcasting during that first hour with you. Anyway, we're going to have a really quick 2 or 3 minute update from Bristol, England. Tony Gosling is coming in here in just a second, and we'll put that up in just 1 second, and then we'll go from there, and we hope to have, I'm going to read this during the second hour. I'm going to read either one or two of my stories, short stories, and if you go to thesecrettruth.com, and at the top there, there's a block on how to order the short story book. It's called Christmas Stories and Christmas Carols. And there's 9 Christmas short stories, and then there's 11 Christmas carols, one of which is an original Christmas carol I wrote called Christmas Star. So if you can do that, that would, in order that, that'll help, you know, support us, and you'll get a really nice Christmas present for Christmas. If you don't have time to download or receive the book itself, you can also order the ebook or read it and download the ebook. And it's $2.99 plus a little tax, about 3 1/4. And you can listen, you can read the ebook on your Kindle reader. So anyway, that's one way, the way to join it. So keep that in mind, and we're going to join Tony Gosling in just 1 second. Hey, Tony, this is George Butler in Austin. How are you? What's that? Are you busy?
Too busy tonight, I'm afraid, yeah.
Okay, well, anything good going on that you need to know?
What's going on? God, that's a question. Well, are we done? Yeah, okay. Check out the... London-based freelance journalist Kevin Cahill.
Okay.
Because he's, I mean, we all know that there's been various threats, something like 5 different agencies threatening the editor of The Guardian, Alan Rushbridge, over these
revelations.
Never mind the fact that they're exposing serious criminality going on within the government agencies, particularly, you know, secret services. So anyway, what Kevin's done is he's filed a lawsuit against 3 big U.S. corporations for taking his data and illegally passing it on to the National Security Agency. That is Google, Microsoft, and Facebook. Now, what's happened is, you know, in British jurisdiction, they have broken British laws by handing this information over to the National Security Agency. And so, interestingly enough, Facebook haven't counterfiled. So that means that they will basically have to pay the £1,000 per person in Britain for everybody who wants to file in county courts here in Britain for having their data given to the National Security Agency. It breaks several laws here in Britain, not least of which is the most fundamental Data Protection Act. And the fact that these internet companies have broken their agreements with us, have handed on private data onto the National Security Agency, actually breaks British law. Facebook are not challenging it. Microsoft are challenging it. And Google are trying some sort of counter-suing technique. So it's interesting that this is going somewhere and that if everybody in Britain was to do the same, then Facebook would have to pay every single person in Britain who's on Facebook £1,000.
Oh, my gosh.
In fact, possibly more. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that this is the first, as far as I can see, actual, other than media legal challenges for information, legal challenges to the Secret Service's rights to ordinary people's private data. In other words, going round the old, going round the houses instead of actually getting a court order. And the fact of the matter is, the British courts are actually quite sympathetic, funnily enough. They're not just part of the establishment. They are rather annoyed that the intelligence services have been going around the court system and not bothering to get court orders for information. Going for these blanket data trawls.
Yeah, I got you. Boy, that is important. Well, Tony, I wish you could be with us longer, but, boy, that's good information to have. I'll put it out.
Yeah, it's okay. And if you look for Kevin Cahill, Cahill, most of the British computer and IT magazines have picked up on this because they're very interested to see where this is going. And
okay.
Like I say, it's a successful case filed in the British courts, and it's not been challenged at all by Facebook, which means they're going to have to pay.
Okay, Tony Gosling from Bristol, thank you for the update. We certainly appreciate it.
All right, George, all the best, mate. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is first short story is The Homeless Duck. Once upon a time, about 2 weeks ago, lived a duck on a lake close to town. This duck's name was Ducky. Ducky spent most of his days paddling around, diving for food. Those days were beautiful, close to nature, surviving in the wild along the banks of the lake, with sunlight streaming through the trees. It seemed of Ducky to be truly a paradise. On the other side of the lake, walking along a path, was a man named Joe. Joe was down on his luck, for all the safety nets had fallen out from under him. One day, Joe had been a useful member of society, but within a short period of time, he found himself on drugs and drunk all the time. Soon after that, all of his friends turned against him. He realized now they didn't give a damn about society at all. Everybody always wanted something. Joe's days were now spent bumming around trying to get back on his feet. But every time he had something good going, something always happened to ruin everything. One day, Ducky was paddling along the bank and saw another duck quacking at a man on the bank. Before Ducky knew it, the man had thrown some bread into the water, and the duck quickly devoured it. What a brilliant idea, Ducky thought, for as a duckling, Ducky had caught on quickly in foraging for food. Now he saw immediately how good a deal this was. From that day on, Ducky quacked at everyone along the bank for food and prided himself on how smart he was. In time, he grew fat and couldn't keep up with the other ducks, who he considered to be stupid for not bumming for food. Over a period of time, he steadily grew more and more indolent and lazy, only bumming for food when he became real hungry. But this bumming wasn't working the same as before. Maybe he scared some people when he was too aggressive. Ducky's feathers had begun to fall out, and one time he even nearly bit the finger off of a little girl. Ducky had not meant to do that, but that didn't stop the little girl's father from throwing a big rock at Ducky with strong indications of anger and hate. Meanwhile, Joe on the other side of the lake was having his problems too. These so-called social agencies were hypocrites, for what the homeless needed were homes, not some stinking cot in an old warehouse. Several weeks later, Joe found himself sitting on the bank of the lake, trying to resolve these issues within his own mind. He had not a cent in his pocket, no food, and earlier, he had sold his watch for a bottle of wine, but before he could drink it, he had broken the bottle. While Joe was sitting there, Ducky paddled up and started quacking for food. Joe threw some rocks at Ducky, but Ducky was hungry and bit Joe's finger. That startled Joe, and he fell to his knees crying. Ducky just looked at Joe in wonderment, then very deliberately, perhaps instinctually, with Joe watching, Ducky waddled to the lake and paddled back into nature. Joe raised himself off of his knees and walked away from the lake back into society. The second story is entitled The Morning After. The year was 10,000,001 according to Hellenian calendar, and Commander Xenix was maneuvering the craft for touchdown in what had been the parking lot of all that remained of a regional shopping center. The heavy growth of thick vines and undergrowth made it very difficult and tricky to find a place that was level and clear enough to land safely. The gravity modification vortex dynamo was working smoothly, enabling the craft to maneuver with precision, hanging, hovering in the sky, slowly settling down. An old calendar clock combination barely hanging on an outside wall was charred, barely supported by a severely destroyed building. It remained stuck frozen on the date of December 25th, 1990, 2 p.m. That had been 1,011 Earth years earlier, making the Earth date of the aliens' landing 3001 A.D. Earth date. The Earth, by that date, had been decimated by a nuclear world war, so there were no humans to mark the date or welcome the aliens. The Hellenians had been aware of the Earth for the last 10 Earth years, but were unable to secure much information because of their home planet of Helena, 8 light years away, made it difficult and time-consuming in securing data on the water planet. This was their first reconnaissance flight to Earth. The trip had taken over 9 Earth years at nearly the speed of light. Xenon was the first to disembark from the spacecraft. Xenon, reporting to Zenex, said, "Commander Zenex, it is such a large structure that it must have been some kind of religious temple to worship the universe of God." "Yes, Exnan, the structure contains certain symbolic designs that would indicate spherical connection to the universe. See that fallen circular-shaped wheel at the end of the building? That is possibly evidence that the universal light source was worshipped." The building was little more than a burned-out hull, for on December 25, 1990, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, unknown to the Hellenians, an atomic airburst at 2,500 feet had effectively devastated the city and shopping center. The scouts had reported back that the main building was laid out so the skylights were in exact alignment with the water planet sun. Other data computated and synthesized the fact that inside many cupels was found shreds of clothing that must have been worshiping robes. The aliens wandered through the ruins for no more than 3 degrees of the sun, taking radiation readings as they explored. The levels were still very high, being lethal to humans, but the Hellenians basked in the radiation because it was a level of intensity that was not lethal to their biosystems, but one that elevated them to a higher mindset level. Exnan turned to Commander Zenex, making a quizzical statement. "There was probably a religious war, don't you think so, Commander Zenex?" "Yes, a high probability," said Commander Zenex. Diana slowly dragged herself out of bed early that morning. It was the morning after Thanksgiving, the year 1990. Punching down hard on the radio clock, she almost knocked it off the night table. Don didn't wake up, thank goodness. He just rolled over. She realized as she was rubbing the sleep out of her eyes that she would have to do battle today to secure for her family the necessities they had to have. Diana groped her way down the hallway of their 3-bedroom, 2-bath home, housing her husband Don and their 2.2 children, Sam and Kathy. She glanced at the kitchen clock. Oh, hell, cussing out loud. She only had 30 minutes to make it to the shopping center. Even then, she would still be an hour early. For to be at the head of the line or not would mean success or failure. Dressing frantically, she pulled on her old jogging shoes and jogging suit. A woman mustn't wear her best on a day like this. No time for full makeup. Just splash on some light makeup, a little blush, waterproof mascara, and she quickly lined her eyebrows. Time to hit the door. Driving to the center, a light rain fell, and on the radio, the song "African Rainbow" intoned. The automatic transmission, shifting ever so smoothly, allowed her to concentrate on thinking about her shopping safari. She drove on another 15 minutes, becoming more hardened the nearer she got to the center, translating to the fact that no one in this world was going to stop her from her goal. Glancing in the rearview mirror, she noticed that one of the eyebrows was vampire-like. She would have to set that straight before getting out of the car. Rounding the corner, Diane could see the front of Super Shoppers Mart, truly the discount store of all discount stores. The rest of the stores in the shopping center weren't open yet. The combination calendar clock at the end of the building read 6 a.m., the 23rd of November, 1990. Good. There stood no more than 100 women in front of the main entrance. She smiled. She had a chance. She could see the way, the path, and the goods, a piece of cake. About 30 minutes before the front doors were open, an assistant manager placed a sign in the front window. It read, all sales will be final upon leaving the store. No refunds, no rain checks or exchanges. Gosh, a ripple. A rumor rippled through the crowd, inciting the women to near riot. The ad that had attracted all the women in the newspaper to the store stated that all refunds and exchanges would be honored as normal business, including rain checks. Several women passed the newspaper ad throughout the crowd. There must have been some of these young, insidious Renaissance ladies, you know, the ones that always show up at Renaissance fairs dressed in gowns, calling each other lady this and lady that. Someone found an old signpost. In no time, several others had wrapped plastic bags around the end, making it into a battering ram, probably suggested by those ladylike or unladylike Renaissance girls. Just as they finished making up the battering ram, they started chanting. The battle cry went up. Get the corporate raiders to hell with the junk bonds. Get the corporate raiders to hell with the junk bonds. Junk bonds, junk store, junk bond, junk store. Chanting, the crowd, including Diana, first started shouting the chants, but a couple minutes later, they were yelling the chant, nearly bursting their lungs. This whipped the crowd into a frenzy. They commenced battering the front door open. The door gave way, and the women streamed into the store. This mass of humanity streaming into the store heard thrash music. Unbeknownst to top management, some neophyte assistant manager had substituted his own thrash music tape for the normal mood music tape. The music did nothing to quieten the mad women, but further activated them to commence moshing between the aisles, a virtual madhouse. The thrash metal music activated some ex-punk ladies to set up a mosh pit in front of the service counter, and they commenced to force the service clerk to mosh dive into the pit. Some formerly Gentile ladies started tearing the displays down, while others, like Dana, grabbed what they had come for and got through the checkout lines as quickly as possible. On the way out with her receipts in one hand and her purchases in the other, all hell broke loose. The few men that had come with the women, mostly wimps and sissies, had taken refuge in the snack bar. All Diana could see were little beady eyes shockingly peering over the snack bar counter. Children were running everywhere, throwing notebook paper hither and fro. Sales clerks were running for their lives. Diana hurried out and watched from outside the store. A helicopter was hovering over the store, lowering down a SWAT team. The SWAT team ran into the store, firing rubber bullets and tear gas everywhere. Huge clouds of tear gas drifted over the scene. Two policemen grabbed Diana, frisking her and quizzing her about her Christmas purchases. Diana had receipts, so they released her. She couldn't believe what was happening. A total riotous situation broken out. Diana continued watching from a parking lot, while some women with non-bulletproof, waterproof mascara streaming down their faces were being led from the store. Others, half-clothed, were using bath towels, which they had not purchased to preserve decency. Diana stayed witnessing this whole debacle until they had loaded the last rioters on the last bus. There had been too many arrested for teeny-weeny little paddy wagons. Diana never saw any of those women again, for in Diana's world of 1990, the worst crime wasn't against the state. A corporate crime was a far worse offense. It was, in fact, a sin. A month later, she found herself and her family sitting in their living room on Christmas morning. They were opening their presents. Sam pulled out his new jeans, hugging his mom. He said, Mom, the boys at school can't make fun of me because I've got cowboy jeans now. Sam ran to the bedroom to try on his new jeans. Diana looked over at Kathy just as her new doll's head fell off. Then Sam ran back in the living room complaining that the zipper on his jeans was broken. Don, holding up his new sports shirt, said, Honey, two buttons are missing. Diana, in a panic, found her own present and hurriedly tore open the wrapping paper off the package, extracting the pantyhose from the box. She noticed an unexplainable run in the pantyhose. Diana was completely demoralized, for she had made so many sacrifices to buy those presents for her family at that supposedly terrific discount sale. With a big frown on her face, she placed her arm around Don and said, War is hell, isn't it, honey? Don replied, Yes, war is hell. Boy, that was the second one called The Morning After. So, we're going to end with some news here. There's an announcement there. I wanted to direct people to celebrate 50 years of SCORE. And SCORE is for the life of your business. It's a mentoring system of retired people. And they go out and they give their time freely, you know, free. I mean, it's free. And they consult with people that are trying to establish businesses and so forth. So anyway, they've been out there for 50 years mentoring people in small business. And these are the kind of people that we must respect and really pay homage to that are trying to turn around this economy and try to
put something good back into the American economy. We have so many things going on. Charlotte and I talked briefly about the Duck Dynasty. And right now, they're saying on Friday there was a report that the Walmart sells out of the Duck Dynasty's merchandise, I guess. I don't know too much about the Duck Dynasty or their merchandise and so forth. But evidently, they have quite a following in the United States. And they have quite a large, very, very loyal, it seems, backing of people that follow them. It says Duck Dynasty's
$400 million empire booms despite gay sex row. Walmart sells out of show merchandise as fans flock to support Phil. And
Phil Robertson is the patriarch of the program, and he was interviewed and said some derogatory things. The gay community felt like they were derogatory. I think it was in line with his own religious beliefs, which are very Christian and very conservative. So he had a right to say what he wanted to. But they've got this political correctness stuff out here now where you can't say anything against the gays or anybody else. Otherwise, you're an unprivileged person. You're no good. We gotta cut this out. Pogba, the other day just recently made a comment and she said that, gosh, what we've gotta do is we've got to let people speak their mind. She called this criticism of Phil, on the Duck Dynasty, a patriarch, a fascist type of in Nazi Germany. This reminds me of Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, they criticized a lot of people in the same way. And, especially the Jews were criticized by the German citizens. So what are we doing here? Are we getting back to some kind of a Nazi type of political correctness? And like they dissed, discredited and put the Jews down in Nazi Germany. Now they're putting down so-called homophobes or people that are against, the gay community. I think they ought to leave them alone and, you know, let people speak their own minds. You can ignore people that you don't agree with, or you can discredit them and you can speak out about it. But to try to take away their living and to crush them economically and business and to just destroy their business, I think is really, really way, way way wrong. That is wrong. I'll tell you that. Being in radio, a number of years ago in the 30s, there was what they called a radio research project that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And it started in about 1937. The Rockefeller Foundation started funding research to find the effects of new business in this mass media on society, especially radio. Several universities joined up and were formed at the School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. So Princeton was the area that they organized, and the people involved were Paul Larsfeld, director of the radio project, Theodore Adorno, chief of the music division, Haley Cantrell, a psychologist at Princeton's University Department of Psychology, Gordon Alport, another Larsfeld's assistant, went on to be the Tavistock Institution leading representative in the United States, and Frank Stanton, a researcher from CBS, sent to the project. He went on to become president of CBS, and I've noticed that just here lately, when we're talking about the JFK assassination, CBS, in my opinion, was one of the worst networks in their reports of what went on there in Dallas 50 years ago. I didn't see much truth in some of their reporting. It was all, you know, single a magic bullet theory, and that didn't go over. I mean, that didn't happen. This bullet had to weave around in there and go through two people and all this stuff. That didn't happen. It didn't happen. I'm sorry. But CBS was there just reiterating all these falsehoods and lies. And the other news people weren't any better. Many of them were just making fallacious reports. And the young people will grab hold of that, and they think it's the truth. They weren't there, and they didn't know exactly what went on. And so the best that they can do is just try to deal with what news that they have. But the internet is out there still. So, we've got news out of Cuba. They are authorizing, car sales now, which they had really regulated out of existence at one time. And, we've got, this radio project. Getting back to that, let me just say a few words of that. The radio project discovered that people were really infatuated with serials, like soap operas. So there was a plethora of differing radio shows that were put together that were serial. In essence, one followed the other, but you never completed the story each time. You always gave rise to another story that would complete the next week and so forth. And so... that's a way that the news, the radio people really got this thing going really good, was that they started these serials. Well, later on, at television in the late 40s and early 50s, you had television that began to come in, and it even got worse. So there they had, with radio, you only had the words and the audio. But with television, you had the audio and the picture, see, and you could mesmerize people at a deeper level. And basically, that's what it is. Entertainment is like mesmerizing, you know, people into a hypnotic sleep state. And in that hypnotic sleep state, they're highly influenced. They're open to influence on it, like on a hypnotic basis. And that's what we have going on in radio and television today. So there are these feeling states that many of these researchers on the radio project uncovered. And those feeling states are very, very pleasant idea states, and where people are beginning to take on ideas and think about how they're incorporated. They become the hero. If there's a hero there on the television set or in the story, then they become the hero. I know when we were watching as young people, Sea Hunt, you know, Lloyd Bridges, and we were all there. Well, we had to go out and get those aqualungs, though, and we did that, that's for sure. But we had to buy those things, and we had to get them and put those aqualungs on and those fins and mask and play Sea Hunt, you know. But that was a very, very powerful influence at that time. And I'm working on another book right now, too, that's going to be like a self-help book, and it's called Be Good to Yourself. So you might be watching for that in the next few weeks or a few months to come out. And so don't go away here. Keep tuning in. And the Duck Dynasty boys are saying we can't go on without the patriarch at the helm. So they're probably in an uproar, and they're on strike probably. Who knows, you know. And this NSA was caught spying on European officials investigating Google. Google was being investigated, so they sicked the NSA on them. Harry Reid has been hospitalized lately, and the city installs urine detectors in public elevators, it says. My gosh. What news is that? I'm on Drudge report here. I'm trying to, the urine detection system installed in Atlanta transit station elevators. My gosh, what are they going in there, huh? Atlanta right now, 54 degrees and overcast, and here in Austin, well, we're looking at a little under 70 degrees. It's been a very, very pleasant day. And it says Obama heroin hits the streets. Obamacare heroin hits the streets. And we're talking about Massachusetts State Police bust Obama heroin. Boy, what a story that is. That's just a breaking story here. Massachusetts State Police on Friday confiscated 1,250 bags of heroin during the traffic stops and many of the bags were labeled Obamacare. Other bags were labeled Kurt Cobain. The traffic stop was made in the town of Hatfield, Massachusetts. During the stop, evidence of illegal narcotics led to a request for a state police canine. The state police said in a statement on the agency's Facebook page, Trooper David Sterninski and Cole Frankie located 1,250 individual bags of heroin in the vehicle. Four people were taken into custody and charged with narcotic violations. Boy, I tell you what, that is something else. So what do we have out here? We got Dope City, you know, USA, huh? And is that gonna stop? You know, we look down at the narcotics dealer there in Mexico, and we're trying to stop the trade and all that down there, and they're going to stop flights coming in, and they got tunnels they're closing down. But we've got to take control of our own emotions and our own needs and our own habits. If people continue to use drugs, which they have, then we're going to have a continuing deterioration in this country of drug users. The debasement of the whole society occurs. You got the broken homes. It's not only drugs, it's alcohol too. So you got alcoholism, you got drug addiction. Oh, let's put in there gambling. Let's put in there that Vegas is the greatest place since sliced bread, and we got to go out there and we got to put money on the line, and we got to gamble. The whole country's turned into one lotto ticket menagerie, hasn't it? Huh? When it gets up to 600 million or whatever it did this last week, there's no telling. I might even put a dollar down on that deal, and I'm against totally lottery altogether. But the sums of money are so big now that it's tempting for anyone, even myself, to buy 10 lottery tickets and see, maybe I might hit on that one, you know? But so it's a system. It's a system of rule, and it's mind-washing and mind-control, and we've been debased. The system, the America that we used to know in the 50s, is not that anymore. It's a drug-infested, alcohol addicted, and also idea addicted to all kinds of games, shooting games and this kind of games, and Star Trek games and Star Wars games. And oh, and then we lose ourselves in those little games, and then they start thinking that those games are the real thing, I guess. I don't know, but they're not the real thing. And it's all a facade. It's all makeup. It's all make-believe. So what do we have? We have Fantasy USA. That's what we have. We have a fantasy world made up of a bunch of just, you know what I mean, ideas, idea-based systems. It's like a field system. We have electromagnetic radiation, a field of electromagnetic radiation surrounding us. And on that, and surrounding that, we have air in there also. So we don't have just electromagnetic radiation, but we have air that's part of this whole system. And in that system, we rise in the morning and with the sun, and we go to work, and we have a job, and we get paid so much an hour. And then we go home, and we turn the television on, or we go mostly it's television. Nobody can afford to pay the ticket price is hardly to go to a football game. They just turn the television on. There it is, folks. Of course, you got to, sit through all kinds of multi-million-dollar advertising commercials, because that's what sells, you know what I mean, the product, right? So we got to go see the people play, and we got a young men out there thinking they're players. They're the ones playing. They're just fantasizing about playing and seeing the big touchdowns made, and then they wear all those coats and all those jerseys and everything, and boy, they just love it. They can't get enough of it, see? And so when you can't get enough of something like that, you become an addict. You become addicted to those kinds of cravings. And so the idea field, the fields out there, you could say, are just as bad, okay, as the physical, okay. The physical thing is bad enough, but when you get ideas that are put forward through radio initially in the 30s,
and then later on television in the late 40s and the 50s until the present time, and at such a tremendous rate of number of channels that you can tune into, we become inundated by the wrong ideas, and those wrong ideas are causing us to become mesmerized and taken away from targeting the real problems. The real problems is that we have a very corrupt America. I talked to this guy that wrote Cheating Culture one time, and he didn't really want to come on the program for one reason or another. He said he's sort of through with that, you know, that book, and it's pretty well run its course, and I still had some questions to ask him. But what occurred to me was corrupting, you know what I mean, the cheating culture. How about the corrupting culture? Because that's what we've got everywhere we go. I know we get on here, and we complain and complain and complain on the air, and you say, well, can you offer? What solutions can you offer? Well, there are solutions out there, and they're not that easy to get to. And one of the solutions out there is to come up with the inability of our great leadership to hide behind a bunch of secrecy. Okay, we've got so much secrecy out here that we don't know really how to come out of this state, this mesmerized state. And it is a mesmerized state. We've got to start forgiving one another. That's, we say, Charlotte and I, we repeat that over and over again, but we can't say it probably enough times, because it is the truth. It's a cult breaker. Forgiveness is a cult breaker. That means that we are recruited into cults, and we have to find means and methods to break out of those cults. The cults have their own rules and regulations and their own ideas to govern that particular group. We hate, you know, they say we hate this group, we hate that group, and they get everybody divided and so forth. But there are global solutions out there, and these global solutions would be, I have about five different global solutions here that I can talk about through the end of this hour, the second hour. And I hope you send off for that book, of short stories for Christmas stories. George Butler put that together into Amazon. Okay, we've got five problems here that I see, and I'm just going to state the problem and state what kind of solution that we can affect here on that. Money problem, the monopoly of money creation. Starting in 1782, in Wilhelmsbad, they put together an idea to take over the Illuminati and the secret society bunch to take over the world by dominating the money creation system, which banking and international banking. The money solution would be to create community banks, which individuals together can begin to create money for themselves as account stakeholders. Number two, education problem. In today's schools, primarily nurture and promulgate and dominate systems of control. The education system was set to support the moneyed rich, and to seed into the ideas of our students certain ideas very heavily on the patriotic side, to fight for the mother, for the homeland, for the mother country, to ward off these devils from overseas, and that way it would protect the assets and money of the real rich within those countries. Number three, communication problem. The communication problem, okay, of all citizens worldwide, we're becoming more, we have a lot of communications now because our internet isn't regulated like they want it to be, like the real elites want. So we're not as regulated on that, and so we're making headway now. The system of rule is being threatened by the communications that we have over the internet. So they're going to find ways to charge us, to control us. They've done this social networking stuff through Facebook and Google and all that other stuff to try to mesmerize us. Actually, they're categorizing us into different categories so that they can begin to take us down. Basically, Okay, the communication solution is continue to maximize the efficiency and access in addition to minimizing the cost to citizens worldwide of communication means. And only individuals would have the right to exchange encrypted communications. All governments would be prohibited from using encrypted means, so their actions would be totally open to the public scrutiny, and that would be total transparency. That's what we've got to get away from. We've got to start denying the top-level elitist the ability to keep things secret behind these facades of national security, which, just like the JFK thing, it was 50 years, 45, 50, 55, 70 years. They're not going to release any evidence that implicates their guilt. And there was definitely guilt on that of the top elitist in this country and in Europe to take out JFK. So that's basically what we've got to start talking about. And these solutions, number four, let's talk about number four. Number four is the hate problem. They continue, the elitist and the real elite try to continue to stir up hatred and resentment for the groups, between the groups. And this fuels transgressions against one another and one group against another. And these cult fighting. It's infighting between cults and so forth. They just continue to rile us up everybody. And so as a result, we can't escape out of that easily. The hate solution is forgiveness. So the solution to hate is to forgive. And forgiveness releases us from thought slavery maintained by the ego, nurtured and supported by hatred. So the ego is nurtured through a hate system and resentment, and it elevates the system because it externalizes that it's the supreme thing. It's right. It's always right. And the other people out there, they're the ones that are wrong, and they don't have the right, correct thoughts. And that's what fuels this, political correctness. If you say something bad against the gays or something, then you're no good. People have a right to express opinions. And the people can criticize that. That's fine. But when it's gotten a sickness where you're taking people down, you know what I mean? As far as, taking out their livelihood and so forth, then I think it's gone too far. And it certainly has done that. So to take it and put it in perspective, then you've got hatred for those people then. And isn't that what runs the whole system anyway? Is that the people that are really manipulating behind the scenes want to continue to cultivate and nurture hatred of all these groups for one another. The gays against the anti-gays, the straights against the whatever, the homophobic against the pro-gay, whatever it may be. Everybody is cultivated into hating and to continue that hate-based system so that they can manipulate everybody. Okay, delusion is the fifth world problem that I see. And the delusional problem, the delusion is synergistically driven, and we all suffer from self-delusion by degree. Okay? And in this state, we forever seek out those inputs that support the ego state and continue this state of denial and ignorance. And so most of the time, the ego perpetuating delusion is the threat. We must strive to attain a better overall realization of the is, or what exactly exists, is what we're talking about here. We're talking about reality. We must try to attain a better, overall, more accurate realization of reality, free from preconceptions seeded in by interpreters. We have our family, we have school teachers, we have political leadership, and everyone seeds in to us a certain idea about a certain, concept and ideas about others and everything else. So to come out of the delusion is to come out of that sleep state, and the sleep state overrides the real self. That's the problem that we see that's going on, is that these systems of thinking about others and the divisiveness support that false self, that false ego state. So as long as that ego is thriving in this and basking itself in these very, very pleasing ideas of self and hatred for the outside world, then it continues to begin it continues its existence. And in that existed state is a state of hate, fueled and in a mesmerized, captured state of slavery. We must truly, with a heartfelt change, start walking in a state of acceptance and works, creating a dynamic through forgiving, of deriving a greater objective means of seeing reality as it is. And that's really what I'm talking about, is to come out of this delusion, is to attain a very objective state of thinking about the world. And in that state of thinking, you can begin to see how you're being used by the real top-level managers and elitists and mind washers. And it's so simple, but you've got to begin to see yourself. And there are three ways to do that. To know thyself, you must be able to accept the negatives about yourself, and using personality tests and friends and give you feedback. That's all important. To know thy world, to know thy thoughts is a number two thing to do. And that's, you must begin to observe your thoughts as they're real time unfolding, and how those thoughts really take you over and mesmerize you and control you. And then the third thing is to know thy world. And that's what we do on this program, what Charlotte Littlefield and I do, is we tried for over 7 years to bring our listening audience, to bring them out of that mesmerized sleep state and to attain a greater objectivity of reality. Now, what is reality? Reality exists, what it is, as it is, the is, exists. And it is outside of our mind. What it is, and it's not changing. It exists. The nature, the form of nature, you could say, is an absolute. It has rules and regulations and laws that it operates within. So you could say that nature obeys the natural law. And in this natural law state, you must begin to see how the world functions. The physicist studies this from a scientific viewpoint, but you as an individual can study it also and take acceptance to the idea and accepting the idea that, yes, the natural law is not dictated or created by any man. It exists apart from man. So the natural law is what it is, and you can't change that easily. There are natural laws out there. If you get up in a tree and jump out, you're going to hit the ground. You're not going to fly up into the air. So the natural law of gravity exists, and it states you can prove it by jumping out of a tree and landing on the ground. The gravity will pull you to the ground. So these are some of the things that we need to keep you know, mentioning and on the air. We want to thank everybody for listening this Christmas.
9/11 families have secured the right to sue Saudi Arabia. Well, I think that's a fine. This article just out today says that families of the victims of 9/11, this is coming out on Yahoo. Okay. Families of the victims of September 11th attacks today celebrated a federal court's ruling that allows relatives of people who died in the 9/11 terror attack to sue Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in 2001 were from Saudi Arabia, and the complaint states that much of the funding for the Al-Qaeda terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. Well, that's quite interesting, because we'll go on here. An attempt to Saudi Arabia to 2002 was blocked. An attempt to sue Saudi Arabia in 2002 was blocked by a federal court ruling that said the kingdom had sovereign immunity. That ruling was reversed Thursday by a three-judge federal panel. My gosh, things are changing out there, aren't they? I'm ecstatic. For 12 years, we've been fighting to expose the people who finance these dastards, said William Doyle, the father of Joseph Doyle, 25, a Cantor Fitzgerald employee who was killed in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. His father used a little bit of a cuss word there. We'll excuse that, though. Anyway, says, Christmas has come early for the 9/11 families. We're going to have our day in court, he told ABC News. The ruling struck down an earlier decision that found Saudi Arabia immune from lawsuits. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said it's in the interest of justice to allow them to proceed. Families who lost loved ones in the September 11 attacks and insurers who lost billions of dollars covering damaged businesses have alleged Saudi Arabia bankrolled Al-Qaeda, knowing the money would be used for terrorism. The lawsuit, filed a decade ago by the Philadelphia firm Cozen O'Connor, accuses the Saudi government and members of the royal family of serving on charities that finance Al-Qaeda activities. Well, you know, you can't hardly ever criticize that. Maybe we're going to get some equity here or some justice here from the justice system. But Charlotte Littlefield and I have been working and looking at this ever since it happened. And we started actually broadcasting on November 1st, 2006, which was about 5 years after, a little less than five years after the 9/11. And we've looked at it backward and forward, and there were a lot of Saudis involved, supposedly, that were on that plane. Now, the question should arise was, did Saudi Arabia, along with some of our deep cover intelligence operatives and agencies, help plan out the 9/11, and that's just why the Saudis were involved? Were they lured into providing certain dupes to be on those planes that supposedly attacked and were flown into those buildings? Or were they told before they got on planes, if they did get on those planes, so to speak, what their duty was? Were they doing an exercise or whatever? And so it remains to be seen exactly what we know the truth about 9/11. 9/11 was an inside job. There's no doubt about it. There's too many different inaccuracies and all kinds of wide open questions left unanswered. You can just tick off the questions one at a time. The planes alone could not have brought down the towers. They just did not have the power and the energy to do that. There's no way that that could have occurred. And so, as a result, it's questionable that they were brought down by just planes alone. It looks like that there was other things involved, other energies that are very, very high-level energies. And to go into that speculates, according to some, very wildly. There were elements of fusion reactions that were present in the area immediately after the 9/11, North and South Towers. And look at Building 7. Building 7 was it was a demolition job. It was it's a classic demolition. Who can dispute that? So we get over and over and over again these people that keep putting up the deal, and they'll come in, and now they're going to say, oh, Saudi Arabia was behind the attack. It's probably that Saudi Arabia, along with some deep cover, probably David Edger and people like that and David Boren, are at the top of this whole thing. We need to look at David Edger, who's lecturing now on terrorism at the University of Oklahoma. And we need to look very closely at David Boren and his activities during this time. He just happened to be having breakfast with the director of the CIA, Tenet, the morning of 9/11. He also put out a press release, and they came up with this name, Osama bin Laden, too quick. It was like the JFK thing. Within 3 hours, they were yelling at the top of their lungs, Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Lee Harvey Oswald. These are classic ploys to go after a dupe that's been set up to take the fall. We think Osama bin Laden, we do not think he lived much longer than a year after the 9/11. He had very bad kidneys, and so he was treating that, having those treated all the time. So we believe that Osama bin Laden did not survive a year or so after the actual 9/11. We do not think that operating out of sanctuaries in Afghanistan and bases there, we do not think he had the assets or the expertise to do such a thing. But the question is that the energy necessary to bring down those two towers was extraordinary. And so that is the most difficult thing to try to come up with, see. The actual energy that was necessary to actually bring down those towers had to be on a very, very high level. And to do that, it took an extraordinary amount of energy to topple the north and south of buildings. And they're not easily brought down by just explosives planted. Now, Building 7, it was a 47-story building, and it was demolition. It was a classic demolition on building number 7 on the north side of the complex. And everyone agrees that. And that came down later on in the afternoon of 9/11. But the actual north and south building took an extraordinary amount of energy to topple those buildings. It had to, one of the key things was that dark of smoke coming out of the buildings had to be, steel that had been oxidized and vaporized. And that's really what we're seeing. The steel was actually vaporized. And that's really one of the keys to seeing that they had to vaporize that inner core as they brought it down to bring it down almost at the speed of free fall. And for it to come down at almost the speed of free fall was another key to seeing what really went on there. So anyway, if you take a look at that and you look at it very carefully, you're going to come up with a very, very different, ending of this whole thing. But anyway, we ask you to take a look at that and see what you have to say. And we're going to be tuning out here right now. We thank you very much for listening to us. And we're going to kind of sign off here in a second.